You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, Madison emergency officials have seen a 400% increase in the number of times they've had to administer Narcan. Later in the show, we'll hear more about that.
First, 30 years ago today, a fire and explosion occurred at the Chernobyl nuclear plant in Ukraine. Explosions triggered a fire that released a plume of highly radioactive fallout into the atmosphere and over an extensive geographical area, including the western regions of the then Soviet Union, as well as Western and Northern Europe.
In fact, the alarm was raised initially not by the Soviet government, but by monitors in Scandinavia, as heard in this 1986 news report on ABC TV.
The first word that something was seriously wrong came from this power plant in eastern Sweden, where workers coming on the job registered abnormally high levels of radiation on their bodies. Although the levels were not high enough to harm humans and no accident had occurred at that plant, it was shut down. And as tests were conducted, similar puzzling reports of high radiation came in from all over Scandinavia. But still, no accidents were reported, leading to the conclusion that the problem was elsewhere, to the east, in the Soviet Union, a fact confirmed to the Soviet people on television tonight.
The Chernobyl disaster of April 26, 1986, was the worst nuclear power plant accident in history in terms of costs and casualties. On this 30th anniversary, we're joined by Robert Schutpeltz. He's the executive director of Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S., which is based in Madison. Rob, welcome to Central Time.
Welcome. Thanks, Veronica.
Well, can you describe what Chernobyl was like before the disaster? Who lived there, and what were the industries?
Well, Ukraine was the breadbasket of the Soviet Union. It was very high in agriculture. It was also large parts were very industrialized. The nuclear facility there was, one of the largest in the region. And, supplied about 10% of all of Ukraine's electricity.
And we talked a little bit about the accident itself, but for the people living, immediately near the Chernobyl reactor, how did that event unfold?
There was a lot of misinformation, and they were told to that they would need to evacuate, but just for, a couple days. So you had this mass evacuation, all piling into buses, with really no personal belongings whatsoever, because they thought they would be able to return to their homes. And as we all know, 30 years after, people still have not been able to go back to their homes.
And so, what does that site look like today? I know there's photographs of wildlife there, but what would you see if you were able to visit?
So there still is a 30-mile exclusion zone around the reactor, where it is unlawful for people to live. Although there probably is about 400 or 500 settlers who have gone back and inhabited that area, but it is it's kind of a desolate area that you can see whole cities that are overgrown and nature has kind of taken over, and still very much contaminated land there. You see a lot of fields that used to be thriving with agriculture that can no longer be used because of the contaminated land.
So you said there are 400 or 500 people who have resettled the land, despite the fact that I guess it's still a health risk. What sort of life can they have living there without infrastructure?
It's very economic. They grow their own plots of food, even though it's on contaminated land. A lot of health issues. Very, very few young people. I mean, it's the elderly that have basically nowhere else to go, that have decided that it's worth the risk to live on contaminated land versus being homeless elsewhere.
Well, your group, Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S., is based here in Madison. What kinds of health issues are you seeing as a result of that disaster?
So the main health risks, kind of both physical health and mental health. A lot of the thyroid cancers and other cancers are very prevalent. A lot of cardiovascular diseases, especially amongst the liquidators who came in after and did a lot of the cleanup work, but mental health issues as well. Just the anxiety about what does radiation do to my body. What is it going to happen to the next generation as young girls at the time, are at the age now of having their own families, just the anxiety and pressures that are put on them, and just lack of trust with government officials because they were lied to throughout this process.
We're talking with Robert Schutpeltz right now, Executive Director of Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S. on the 30th anniversary of the Chernobyl disaster. And what did the survivors, Robert, tell you? You talked about mental health issues, but what do they tell you about their memories of that time and how they've moved on with their lives?
Many of them don't like to talk about it. They kind of have, tried to put it in the past, even though they are, living day to day. The people that we work with there are part of a network of community centers that were set up by the United Nations. And they're doing whatever they can to help heal their communities and move past Chernobyl.
What are you looking at in terms of resources to help them? Do you have what you need, and how is the effort going so far?
We're an all-volunteer organization, we do whatever we can to provide support. We've done a number of things as far as providing grants to these centers to run programs so that they can have greater outreach into the more rural areas. We've sent a medical shipment to a local hospital there with much needed medical supplies. And also, maybe even more important is, providing training so that they can, learn how to work and with those affected with cancer and, kind of the social work, aspect that, just was not prevalent in their culture.
You mentioned the fears about the next generation as young girls at the time are ready to start families. Do you know the answer to those questions about how reproductive systems might be affected and what they can do, if anything, to ameliorate things that happened?
Time is, will be the answer to that. I mean, there just really is no hard data as to how this will affect, generations into the future. These centers do, provide, education for young women as far as, what types of food to eat and how to, stay as safe as possible and as healthy as possible throughout the process. But really, there isn't a lot of hard data as far as, what the exact scientific and health medical impact will be going forward.
Now, Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S. is based in Wisconsin, in Madison. How did you come to be based in Wisconsin?
It was our founder was Norma Berkowitz, who is a retired social work professor at the UW. And shortly after the Chernobyl accident, she had gone to a conference that was being held in Moscow and met these five wonderful new leaders of these community centers and fell in love with them and came back and said, hey, these people have such a monumental task in front of them. What can we do? We're blessed here in Madison, Wisconsin. What can we do to help these people, halfway across the world? And so she founded Focus and, have ever since been supporting them. We've been able to raise and send close to $200,000 worth of aid over the years to that region.
Robert, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you.
That was Robert Schutpeltz, Executive Director of Friends of Chernobyl Centers U.S., which is based in Madison. He joined us to talk about the challenges that survivors of the Chernobyl disaster are still facing 30 years later.
It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, we look at the economic benefits that the arts bring to Wisconsin communities, according to our next two guests.
First, there's been a lot of concern about income inequality in the United States and around the world. Miles Little set out to document extreme wealth and extreme poverty in the world with photographs. The result is a photography exhibition and a book called 1%.
Miles Little joined us on Central Time earlier this year. He's a senior editor at Time Magazine and curator of the 1% Project. Miles, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
Well, what were you looking to document with your new book and exhibit, The 1% Project?
I wanted to show wealth all around the world present day, but in maybe a more nuanced or complete way than you would typically see in, you know, the movies or in caricature. I wanted to show not only opulence, but also education and work and leisure and family, religion, and additionally talk a little bit about sort of the hollowing out of the middle class and the working class as well.
And in the foreword to your book, you write that we think we understand wealth, as you said, through TV, through tabloids, but that we're really only seeing a drop in the bucket. What did you mean by that?
Mm-hmm. Well, if you ask a typical person on the street, you know, give me an example of a really rich person. A lot of people might, you know, say an athlete, because in America, athletes are paid really high. So I did a little research and found out that in 2014, the highest paid athlete in the world was the boxer Floyd Mayweather, and he made, pardon me if I'm getting the number wrong, but $105 million, which is a lot of money, but I compared that to the highest paid hedge fund manager in the world, a guy who is, for all intents and purposes, unknown to the average man or woman on the street. A guy named Kenneth Griffin, who made $1.3 billion in 1 year. So we don't have a great sense of how rich the rich are.
Right. There's a statistic in your book that actually even surprised a few of us here in the media at Wisconsin Public Radio. And I guess someone had asked average people on the street what they thought the pay-to-pay ratio was between the top-tier CEOs in the world and ordinary people. And most people said, I think, something like 30 to 1.
Mm-hmm.
And the real answer was 350 to 1.
Yeah, yeah. Amazing, right? So I make one, and he or she up there makes 350.
Yeah. Things like that are interesting to document. So how did you go about getting that on film so that people could actually see what we're talking about and not just hear numbers like that?
So I did a lot of, I just sort of dove down that rabbit hole of online photo research, you know, going to websites of photographers I respect, maybe going to a photo agency like Magnum, which has a great online digital archive. Also doing text research, reading books, reading articles to make sure that what I'm searching for is relevant. Again, I didn't want this to be nothing but photos of fancy cars or big houses. I wanted to really try to enter the world of modern-day finance, for instance, or peer into the lives of Russia's elite, for example. There's a great project by Anna Skladman, Portraits of the Children of the Wealthy of Russia, which happens to be actually the number one most unequal developed country in the world. I read a statistic that said something like 110 billionaires control maybe about a third of all wealth in the country. Occasionally, there would be a photographer I would discover for this project through a coworker. I am a photo editor at Time Magazine, where I commission covers and features although this project is very much a personal, independent project. And so, you know, in the day-to-day of my job, I'll hear about a great new photographer from a coworker, for instance. But the majority of the photos were found simply alone doing that web research.
Well, when we see TV shows about super wealthy people, or maybe we see the insides of their homes in magazines, it's hard, I think, for anybody not to sort of just admire that and to want that for yourself.
Yeah.
And is
yeah.
that why that you decided to include people who are living in poverty at the other end of the spectrum alongside the super wealthy?
Yeah, great point. There is an undeniable allure to wealth, and I think the sort of beautiful craftsmanship that I hope you see in the photos sort of hints at that. You know, we're seeing beautiful infinity pool on the top of a hotel in Singapore. That's the image on the cover. We're seeing gorgeous, opulent opera houses and things like that. It is undeniably attractive. But it was absolutely important to balance that out by talking about pressures on the American middle class. For example, you know, the decline of the manufacturing base that once sort of created the American middle class, that is hinted at in the book. We're also seeing a little trace here or there of the poor. There's an amazing picture from South Africa by Michael Sabotsky of people who are rummaging around in a rubbish dump for, trying to get food or new belongings. And I think a little bit of darkness amidst all this beauty and allure, I think, makes a very powerful statement. A little bit of darkness offset by a lot of lightness almost seems that much more dark.
We're talking with Miles Little right now. He's a senior photo editor at Time Magazine and the curator of the 1% Project. It's a book and also an exhibition documenting the super wealthy around the world and also poverty around the world. Let's talk a little bit more about the photographs. There's one fascinating photograph of a congregation at a church that you say Jesus believes that Jesus wants people to be wealthy and the people there. Can you tell us about that picture?
Mm-hmm. This is by a great documentary photographer named Nina Berman, and it's a church in Atlanta, Georgia, I believe, that preaches the prosperity gospel. Now, what that means is that God wants us to be rich and be prosperous, and the preacher was tremendously successful. He had thousands, if not tens of thousands, of followers and made millions of dollars off of this congregation, many of whom were working class, according to the photographer. And I think it is to me one of the more dispiriting images in the project. It speaks not only about this church, but in my mind, it also speaks about a larger idea that I see in American culture of the celebration of the powerful by the powerless. You know, a cheerleading role that the powerless take on for themselves to promote the better off. And I'm not totally convinced that that millionaire pastor needs our money. Or our support, frankly. He seems to be doing okay for himself. I think that there's another image in the book which is somewhat related by Juliana Sohn, and it's a beautiful image of a gentleman who is cleaning one of the Hollywood stars, you know, the little bronze plaque in Hollywood. He has no legs, but he's clearly, you know, working very hard to put food on the table. And I respect him for that effort. But again, what is compelling to me about it is the larger metaphor, this idea of the powerless celebrating the powerful.
And you've got a great quote from a billionaire equity investor who said that wealth gaps like the one that we're seeing right now, that they cannot last. What do you think he was getting at?
He says that looking back in history, this kind of inequality is fragile, and that through some way, through war or revolution or simply much higher taxes, you know, things will get equalized. We saw, you know, I think that there's actually a chorus of very wealthy people around the world who are starting to see that this is bad PR. You know, this is not going to help anybody, whether it's the poor, the middle class, or the wealthy, because if you get enough angry people voting in enough elections, you know, that wealth in the upper 1% might very well be challenged sooner or later.
Miles, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Miles Little is a senior photo editor at Time Magazine, and he's a curator of the 1% Project.
Coming up, we'll talk to guests from Arts Wisconsin and the League of Wisconsin Municipalities about the first annual Creative Economy Week here in the state. It started Sunday. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.
Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight at 7, NPR brings us live results from 5 presidential primary contests with lots of delegates at stake in both parties. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, we're in the midst of Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin. The week is put on by Arts Wisconsin and the League of Wisconsin Municipalities to highlight the power, impact, and benefits of the arts here in the state.
And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Are you part of the Creative Economy? Are you an artist in Wisconsin, and how do you think the arts benefit the state's economy? You can call now at 800-642-1234, and you can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
Ann Katz and Gail Sumi are here with us to talk about Creative Economy Week. Ann Katz is Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin. Gail Sumi, Communications Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. Ann Katz, by the way, also a member of the Wisconsin Public Radio Association Board of Directors. Ann, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And Gail, welcome to the studio.
I'm really glad to be here. Thank you.
And let's start with you. We've been throwing around this phrase, creative economy. What do we mean by that?
Well, that's a really good question. I could spend the entire time talking about just that. It's the intersection of the creative workforce, so the people that work in arts-related businesses and organizations or are creative entrepreneurs, the creative workforce itself, so the businesses that make up the creative part of the sector. That's everything from nonprofit organizations to design firms, media, architecture, anything to do with creativity, and creative communities or creative states or countries. And you put that all together in a big mix, and that's the creative economy. That's what we're living in right now.
And can we put some numbers on the benefits of the creative economy to the economy as a whole?
Well, we have some information, and we're really working hard on getting more. So we know that as of 2012, and we're going to get new numbers next year, the nonprofit arts sector has a $535 million economic impact. So that's money that people spend when they go to an arts event. They spend it on hotels and parking and meals and babysitters and shopping. That's for sure. So that's an economic impact that provides tax revenue that helps generate revenue and income in a community. We also know that according to Dun & Bradstreet, which is the company that tracks business development in this country, there are almost 10,000 creative businesses in the state and over 42,000 creative jobs, so full-time jobs. People are making money, hopefully, to support their families, buy a house, send their kids to school. So those are the kinds of numbers we have right now. We're working with the Department of Workforce Development to get more numbers on the creative industry, so we're trying to generate more research.
And Gail, that's the creative economy. So what's happening during Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin?
There are a lot of things going on during Creative Economy Week. municipalities are passing resolutions. There's a jazz festival in Eau Claire. There are people doing fabulous things in all municipalities, one kind or another. And it's really about placemaking. It's creating community. And to just build on what Anne was saying, municipalities are so glad to be a part of this because we will always pick up the garbage, you know, enforce the speed limits, mow the lawn in the parks. But now the police are also helping to facilitate the festival in the park. And the lawn is getting mowed before the festival. And we're passing food cart ordinances. We're making things happen in our communities in partnership with the arts.
And Gail, are a lot of communities around the states taking this idea of a creative economy seriously, trying to integrate it into their planning in the short and long run?
Absolutely they are. I was in Eau Claire over the weekend, and they had a jazz festival, and I met with one of the city council members, and she said just a few years ago, investing in the arts would have been questionable, but now it's a no-brainer. So it really is becoming part of the fabric of Wisconsin.
Now, let's talk, Anne, about the idea of the creative economy, not just in the raw numbers it brings in, but as part of the identity of a place that then in turn might make residents, workers, and employers find that place attractive.
Well, I just had lunch this afternoon with Greg Wright, who's director of Create Portage County, which used to be called the Arts Alliance of Portage County, but is now really looking at the creative economy and working on it from the ground up as an engine for the Portage County area. He said that Portage County used to be known sort of as the place where you'd go through to go on your way to some other big place somewhere else. And now they're really working, and they've got a new mayor's committee. The Portage County government is working with them, the business council, the tourism industry, the local people. They're really working on defining Stevens Point and Portage County as a place where the arts spring from the grassroots, where creative people want to live, work, and play. That's a good place to visit, a good place to live. There are many, many communities like that. Wanakee, which used to be known, which still is known as the only Wanakee in the world, is now has been working on a creative economy initiative so that they are trying to brand themselves so people know about the incredibly creative people they have there and the good school system and the things that there are to do and the small businesses. So I could name many, many examples of communities working on branding, planning, and planning is key so that they have good quality of life for everyone. They have businesses of different kinds. They have interesting things to do. And that's really happening in communities of all sizes around the state.
Talking about Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin with Ann Katz and Gail Sumi. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this an important part of your community? The arts, music, public festivals, how important are they in deciding where you want to live? 800-642-1234. Gail, you mentioned this as a city service. And, you know, a lawnmower is going to work the same in Milwaukee or Mosinee. If you're going over the speed limit, you're going over the speed limit,
right.
Any small town, big city. But it seems like the creative economy we're talking about is a way to really do something unique, that there's not a one-size-fits-all approach from municipality to municipality. Do you see that playing out in our towns and cities in Wisconsin?
Absolutely, I do. It's the library programs and the community centers that support the quilt show or the yoga class, the literacy classes and programming in the libraries. And again, the music festivals, the food carts in neighborhoods. It's really about creating community in a place that people want to live.
And I've talked to people, Anne, and I've talked to you about this too, around the state who are kind of the connectors or the firebrands that get these things going. And, you know, in some place it might be the person who runs local weekly magazine, it might be a city official here, mm-hmm. concerned community member. Do you see that? Do you see lots of just, there's that one person who takes the lead and makes something happen?
Well, you definitely need leadership. Leadership and creativity, those are the aspects of the creative economy that we need and that we see. It does take one person to sort of get the spark going. Often that's a mayor or a city council person or a tourism person or just a community citizen who thinks that there should be something happening. What I've been talking about lately more than ever is collaboration and partnership, because there has to be somebody with a good idea and the energy and enthusiasm to start that process, but nothing will happen unless people work together. So the really exciting thing that Gail and I are seeing, that the Arts Wisconsin and the League are seeing these days, is this sense that, okay, we are exploring this idea, we have amazing assets in our community, in our region, we have to learn more, we have to do more, we have to plan more, we have to do this together, because it's not one group that's going to benefit, it has to be the whole community. And that's not different, because people work together, but I think that there's a real sense that we have to collaborate, for people are collaborating for the greater good, and communities are doing that as well. And it's a pretty exciting time.
Did you want to add to that, Gail?
It is, absolutely. I think the fact that Ann and I are sitting here together, Arts Wisconsin, the League of Municipalities, is more than symbolic. It's important that this partnership thrive.
And we've had a good partnership for the past few years. We've done awards at their conferences. We've shared information. But we were pretty much sitting and having coffee, and we were talking about all this creative economy development. And I don't know who's came up with the idea, but we said, hey, let's do a creative economy week. Let's make this happen. And so this is the first annual. We'll keep it going.
Yep.
Let's bring in our callers now at 800-642-1234. We've got Scott on the line in Toma. Scott, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Scott?
Well, about 4 years ago, I got on the Oprah Winfrey Show, and one of the things Oprah said to me, she said, you know, it's awfully lonely at the top. Make sure that if you become successful, you bring other people up with you. So it got me started thinking about doing music festivals to help promote independent artists. So I started in my own small town. I'm from Toma. And I started a music festival called Americana Music in the Park. And over the course of the last 5 years, it's grown to be, we get about 400 people each time we do it. It's gone so successful, we started another music festival called Tran Jam Music Fest, because we're the cranberry capital, of course, you know. But it's really helped our entire economy. We have people come from other communities. We have, you know, people that talk about Toma outside of Toma now because of what we offer as far as music in the park and things that we have. I mean, I think that before I gave the option for our community for people to see the value of music and creative arts, I think a lot of people thought of it as just kind of a pastime, a hobby. They didn't see it as a true way to create an economy for our town. I read a study once that said that there was a correlation between, if you can raise the cultural arts of the community, you can also raise the economic development, and vice versa.
Scott, I want to cut in before I let you go. When is the next festival coming up there in Toma?
Our first one for the new season is May 25th, and it's 6 o'clock to 8:30.
Fantastic, Scott.
We'll
one
there.
Month away. Yeah, well,
yeah,
so both of you were hastily jotting down
Absolutely.
Notes as Scott was talking about. Who wants to go first?
Well, thank you for that information, Scott. Now we know we need to go to Toma for the music, but it's one example of the kinds of things that are happening around the state and, again, in communities also of all sizes, bringing people together, looking at their assets, finding new ways for people to make money and to enjoy their community. Thank you for that example. We appreciate it.
And you can do it anywhere, really.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin and Gail Sumi from the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. It's Creative Economy Week in the state. It started Sunday. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you think it's important to invest in the arts here in the state? What is the state of arts in your community? Are you a part of this creative economy? Do you support the creative economy in your town? What would you like to see happen? Call 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. And we're continuing our conversation now about Creative Economy Week with Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin and Gail Sumi from the League of Wisconsin Municipalities.
And you can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the value for you of having arts, a creative economy in your local community, music festivals, quilting fairs? What do you see as the benefit of this creative economy? Is it important to invest in the arts? Call in now at 800 800- 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page. We'll bring on another caller now. Joanne is with us in Reedsburg. Joanne, hi.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call, and hello to Anne. This is Joanne calling with Reedsburg Arts Link. And a couple of years ago, inspired by the work of the Worm Farm Institute, who created the Fermentation Fest, which is an annual festival that we have here in Reedsburg, I created a small, along with others, created a small arts nonprofit called Reedsburg Arts Link, and we've been going gangbusters. I feel passionate about the role of art in terms of its ability to build not just economies, but to really build communities. And I saw it firsthand in much larger communities when I was living in New York and the Twin Cities. I wanted to say a couple things about what Sauk County is doing. Sauk County has funding available. It's one of the few rural counties in the state of Wisconsin that has funding available for the arts, which is huge. And Sauk County is so committed, and Ann probably knows about this, that they have recently developed a creative economy initiative for Sauk County, and they are, in fact, hiring a planner who's passionate about creating vibrant, active, authentic communities, and they're paying this person a real salary.
All right, Joanne, thanks a lot for calling in. There's so much we could get into there, but let's talk about that idea of investment. She's talking about Sauk County putting, this is the county government, I assume, putting some money into this. Are we seeing this elsewhere in Wisconsin or at the state level, Anne?
Joanne, nice to hear from you. I was glad to see you last week. We could talk for a long time about Sauk County and Reedsburg and Baraboo and Spring Green and the communities in that area alone. They have made a commitment. Sauk County is one of only three counties in the state that has a public arts funding program. Other places are supporting the arts, but in Sauk County, they are putting their money where their mouths are. Reedsburg has supported the Fermentation Fest, Arts Link, Public Art, a lot of different things. Baraboo has a public art committee. Spring Green obviously has a lot of arts going on. So investment in the arts is an important topic that I've talked about on this show before and we could keep talking about, because people are doing amazing things with very little resources, but there needs to be resources in some way. So people are finding resources on the local level. We're working on the state level to grow Wisconsin's investment. The league is very much a partner in that, and we want to make sure that there are resources out there so that everyone can participate.
And Gail, on that funding issue, we were talking about partnerships earlier. Do you see a lot of people looking for either public-private partnerships to make that kind of investment, or maybe even state and local partnerships?
Both. Both state and local and private partnerships with government. Those are the kinds of things that are making things happen. If you look back to Eau Claire again at the Confluence Project, for example, the investment that the state made in that new facility that will bring the community together. And Anne has some good examples from other parts of the state as well. In Appleton, there's the Mile of Music Festival. The mayor has made a huge investment in that festival in terms of their resources that they put towards that. So a lot of those kinds of things are going on, absolutely.
Joanne, thanks a lot for that call. And if there's anything like Fermentation Festival and the Art Detour anywhere else in the world, I'd be surprised. It's definitely a unique stamp on that community. We're talking about Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin. We've got Ann Katz from Arts Wisconsin, Gail Sumi from the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is the state of your local artistic creative community? Maria joins us next in Madison. Maria, hi.
Hi, yes. What a great initiative. I see it's an opportunity to for diversity, too, because I live here in Madison, Wisconsin, and I believe the Hispanic community is growing so fast here, and it's a lot of people that they kind of travel to Latin America. We can offer, a lot of music, food, and people can learn, you know, about that we exist, we are here, not just say, oh, the Latin American just come here and work, you know, we can do more than that and educate more and collaborate, you know, with that great program that she is offering.
Maria, thank you so much for that call. So that's a way to approach this, maybe a way to bring in different ethnic communities, the Latina community, as Maria is talking about, or communities could tap into their cultural heritage and history, too.
Well, and that's a very important component of the arts. I mean, humans have come together in creative ways and celebration through the arts since the beginning of time. And so Wisconsin has such a great diversity of people and cultures and heritage, and using the arts to celebrate those cultures and to teach us about the different cultures, and for people to understand different cultures, I think is a really important component. It really is all about everybody participating in the arts, not just some people who can afford the price of a ticket, but everybody being able to participate, learn from, and get to know each other through the arts.
And keep in mind that this is the first year. It's the first annual Creative Arts Week, so we'll grow this over time. But it really recognizes the paradigm shift in the economy. This is the new economy.
It is the first Creative Arts Week. Are you seeing, Gail, as you got the word out about this, a hunger for this kind of thing in Wisconsin?
We are. We were very pleased by the number of municipalities that adopted a proclamation in support of the Creative Arts Week, that are doing things around the week. We had a lot of fun in our League magazine. We published a number of poems, which is the first time we've ever done that, one by Ann Katz's employee, Aaron. And a number of poet laureates, a poet laureate from Amory, and the poet laureate from Madison. So this is just the beginning.
And what are you hoping for the future of Creative Economy Week here in Wisconsin, Ann?
Well, I think we're going to try to do more to get the stories out about what's happening in the creative economy. We got a million stories. So getting those online, doing events around those kinds of stories. We're also, I think, going to do more to encourage communities to do more locally. For example, Eau Claire, which we keep mentioning, they just kind of bundled together everything that was happening in the community in the week and called it the Creative Economy Week. So we really appreciate everything that people have done on the local level, and we're just going to keep growing this.
Very briefly, Anne, if there's one of those spark plugs out there who's saying, yeah, I want this in my community, how could they get in touch with you?
Well, our website is artswisconsin.org.
And ours is lwm-info.org. And, but we're going to point you to Arts Wisconsin.
Right. So that we have all the Creative Economy Week information on our website, and it's linked up to the leagues.
As part of our partnership.
We'll leave it there for now. Ann, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks very much.
And Gail, thanks for coming up.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Ann Katz, Executive Director of Arts Wisconsin, and Gail Sumi, Communications Director for the League of Wisconsin Municipalities. They joined us to talk about the first annual Creative Economy Week that kicked off Sunday. And you can share what's going on in your community. Still time to do that over at the Central Time Facebook page.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come here on Central Time on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.